Hi, everyone. This is Christopher Paolini, and I am here talking with none other than the awesome Jennifer Hale.
This is Jennifer Hale, and I am here talking with none other than the awesome Christopher Paolini.
And of course, Jennifer, you have read the audiobook version of To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal experience from my side. What an incredible book. It's vast. It's surprising. It's fun. It's deep. It's beautiful.
Can I use those as blurbs on the back cover?
You have my, yes, you have my hearty endorsement.
Well, and this is the Mutual Admiration Society, because I feel incredibly lucky to have had you reading the audiobook and to have you bringing it to life and bringing Kira to life, the main character, because without that, this audiobook just wouldn't be what it is. So thank you.
Thank you. It was such an honor and such a delight, man.
So I guess the question is, you know, how did you end up on this project? And it's sort of this roundabout way, because you and I met at the Supernova convention back in, what, 2012? We crossed paths?
Or 14, one of those, yeah.
Yeah, it was right after my last big book came out. And I'm a big fan of the Mass Effect series and some other work you've done. I didn't realize you did a voice for Jedi Knight 2 Jedi Academy, which I still play that game. So yes.
My God, that's fantastic.
But yeah, so we were in the process of looking for an audiobook reader for To Sleep in a Sea of Stars. And, you know, that was a difficult thing, trying to find the right voice and the right feel. And we were all sort of tearing our hair out. And then it was my dad who came along and said, no, what we need is someone like Commander Shepard. We need like Jennifer Hale. And I just kind of said, well, funny you should mention that. And I think I mentioned it to Tor, and I pinged you on Twitter. It was like the next day.
And why
did you say yes? Because this is your first audiobook, right?
It is my first audiobook. I have a few friends who do audiobooks, and it's a rigorous, intense process. And I didn't have a complete understanding of it. Anything that's heavy on the engineering is not my bag. That's not what I do. And you don't want me doing that necessarily if I'm there as your talent, as your person speaking and communicating, because then my attention's split. And you're not getting all of me. I just had never had time to do it. And I remembered that conversation. I remembered you saying that, and I was like, oh, that sounds like fun if that ever happens. And then you are one of the rare few who follow through. And holy cow, when you messaged me, I was like, that could be really fun. I've never done an audiobook. I don't know if I'll be any good at it, but I enjoy listening to them. I listen to a ton of nonfiction. I don't do a lot of fiction. And so I just thought, let's see what happens. I hope I don't disappoint, and I'll do my best. What are you going to do? You know?
Well, and from my point of view, you know, finding someone who could read, who had some strength to her voice and could do justice to the character in the world, was really important. And that's something I think you have such a wide range, but that's something you bring to a lot of your roles, I think.
Thank you. The acting side of it. I think that was one of the more daunting balances to find for me, because when the first audiobook one does is nearly 900 pages, and there are 50 characters, finding a way to distinguish all of those characters, but without going too far into what are my typical references, which are characters in games and characters in animation and varying styles of animation. And I really relied on Callum so much. Thank you, Callum, for guidance and for, you know, when to bring it back. And I don't want to throw the reader out of the book, you know, and yet I want to honor the characters and be consistent, because my God, these characters, there's some fantastic characters in here. I mean, Sparrow is like near and dear to my heart. Her mouth. Oh my God. I love her.
So I have to ask, this is the author in me. Since this is the first time we've chatted since you finished the book. So, I hope you enjoyed it.
I mean, Callum will attest that there were, I think, 3 or 4 points as we were recording where I couldn't talk. I got so choked. I had to just stop. Mm-hmm. And it gets me thinking about it still. There's a moment with a character who has dealt with starvation, And the way that that's handled in the end, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to cry. It's beautiful. It was so small and so perfect and just so moving. Yeah. And there's so many moments like that. I loved the world. I loved the evolution of the character, and I loved the piece of magic that's in there. And to me, this book was, you know, at the risk of sounding super trendy and annoying, it had a very meta aspect to it. Cause I was like, yeah, that's how the universe works. You know, I'm reading it going, yeah, of course, that is the law of evolution of all beings and all kinds, you know, and it's played out in this novel. And I'm like, what were you channeling, Christopher? It's so great.
Aw, thanks. Well, I mean, I think we can get into a few spoilers since presumably anyone who's listening to this or watching this has hopefully listened to or read the book.
I'll be of assistance. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
But I love that you brought that up because for me, a large reason I write these books is almost the mythical aspect, as you say, you know, those lead larger questions and deeper questions, which to me make all of the running around and shouting and fighting in the story worthwhile. And because let's face it, there's a lot of running around and shouting and fighting in the story. But if it doesn't mean anything in the end, then why write it and why read it?
Exactly.
So as the audiobook reader, what was the hardest part for you? Was there any character or, aside from just the sheer length of the project?
One of the hardest parts for me, I think, was not going too far with the characters because they were so clear and so specific. And there's a lightness in the background running because a book like this that is so massive in its scope and so deep in its technological aspect and so huge in the weight of what's at stake, it's wonderful to find that lightness breathing through the seams, you know. And in those moments, it was a little tempting to go a little over the top. Callum was like, no, I was like, oh, sorry. It was just so fun. technically keeping all the different characters separate when they would disappear for 100 pages or that I had my trusty voice memos like right here and I go, hold on. And I'd scroll for pages till I'd find, oh, there's that one. Okay. They're the entropists again, you know?
Yeah.
That, and really, I think partly because it's my first audiobook and because I don't know the experience of the listener yet and where to adjust, you know, there was a constant presence, awareness for me of, is this on target? Is this the way it needs to be? Am I doing it in, am I doing the book service? Am I doing the proper service to the book? Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the same balance that I'm trying to strike as the writer, because I like my puns and, you know, actually my agent, Simon, who's a wonderful man and a wonderful agent, He threatened me with ripping out all the puns early in the process. And I put my foot down and I said, no, puns have to stay. You know, there's a reason for it though, because I've watched a lot of science fiction and I'm sure you have as well. And sometimes when the stories get too dark, it actually feels unrealistic to me to a point where, yes, the world has ended and, you know, horrible things are happening, but human beings, especially human beings who are in difficult situations, they crack jokes, you know. Soldiers, paramedics, nurses, they have some of the darkest, blackest, filthiest humor you ever hear.
Yeah, they do. I heard somebody once say, who was a medical professional, that Scrubs was far more accurate than ER, you know? Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I love that. I love that scene about the newts. You know, everybody had the dialogue around the newts and everybody just took off on the newt puns. I could not even. It was fabulous.
Well, I mean, that's what people do too, isn't it?
It is. It was so much fun. Yeah, and I really, the writing, there were a few scenes where I would stop and I would, you know, because I was reading a story essentially to a person, you know, there were moments when I would sort of go a little too much into the feeling of the character and I'm like, real human beings don't do that. And I'd redo it and back up. Oh, no, they cover. We're going to cover. Mm-hmm. And the world's ending. You need a coffee. You know, that sort of a thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think the book's actually written in that style a little bit. I actually tried to keep a little bit of reserve because I think that's how people do act and interact. So I feel like I owe you an apology for making you read all of the technical stuff at the back of the book.
Well, maybe some hazard pay.
Hazard pay.
That was something. My God. I had some incredible epiphanies as I was reading that, just about stuff that we won't go into now, but it was fascinating. Subliminal and superliminal space. And I certainly identified every consonant my particular physiology ever had a problem with.
Yeah.
I have like 7 new things in my repertoire of tongue twisters to warm up. Subliminal space. And
well, it was one of those things that I felt like I really wanted to write to build out the world, but it's one of those things where, because I'm not a physicist myself, I understand it when I'm writing, and I understand the big concepts even now, but to really get it on a granular level, it's like I have to sit there and think about it for days. And then as soon as I stop thinking about it, a lot of it just kind of slips away.
Well, because you're building context. You don't have context. Not like you've got a bucket and you're putting stuff in it. You're actually having to build, I mean, for me, I'm having to build this bucket, and I have maybe like 3 frames of it, so lots of water leaking out of mine. But I've got little pieces of it.
Yeah, same. That's how I feel too. So I'm kind of curious. You know, you've done so much work in the science fiction genre. I mean, are you a big science fiction fan yourself? I know I read somewhere that you don't play video games. But I'm just kind of curious about your own interests with fiction.
I love sci-fi. I love to watch it. My reading, right? For many years now, has been nonfiction, because I'm an expansion junkie. I love to expand myself, my frame of reference, my who am I? And I had forgotten, I think, until I sat down and read this book, I had forgotten that I can do that through fiction as well. You know, I had been so literal and so hands-on with it. But yeah, huge sci-fi fan. I don't actually have a lot of time to watch TV or do things or any of that stuff. But I love the sometimes operatic possibility of sci-fi. I love that it can throw our collective hat over the wall, so we can have something to aspire to and somewhere to go. Some of my favorite moments in escapism, which is a way of coping with modern life, have been through sci-fi. You know, there was one episode of, have you seen The Orville?
I haven't had a chance yet. I've heard good things though.
The McFarlane show. And it's an homage to so many different aspects of sci-fi. So, you know, a couple of the super classic ones, very obviously. But the season finale of the first season of The Orville made me feel okay about everything. It took place a few hundred years in the future, and all the stuff we were so stressed about, you know, at the time of when the episode actually started on the timeline. They time traveled to the future or something, had contact with people in the future. And everything they thought was so horrible, and it really looked pretty bad. They were like, fine, no big deal. And I was like, thank you, sci-fi. Even though we know now time travel is a myth. But yeah, thank you, Christopher.
One of the things I had to decide when working on To Sleep was like what kind of future to portray. And, you know, you don't want to go too far. I mean, unless you're like preaching an idea, you don't want to go too far one way or another and make it unrealistic to the point where humans, unless they've evolved into something new, humans are behaving in a way that we don't recognize as humans. But at the same time, I think that you do have to make a couple of statements. You do have to make choices on what you think is going to be important or not important. One thing that I was trying to touch on, and I didn't embrace this as much as maybe another author would have, but it was still important to me, was basically a sense of weirdness. You know, cause, you know, we have Asimov, we have Heinlein, we have Clark, and they were all trying to predict the future. But the one author who really got the future more than anyone was Philip K. Dick. You know, when you look at the headlines nowadays, we're living more in a Philip K. Dick universe than we were in, you know, Heinlein or Asimov. So that was something I was trying to touch on every once in a while. It's like, yes, there's big mythic epic things happening in this story, but there's some weirdness around the corners too. And that's because humans are weird.
I loved that. You know, that's a really interesting question. Like, I'm curious about your process as a writer. How do you go from an idea to a project this massive, to something as giant as To Sleep in a Sea of Stars? How do you do that?
Years. Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Years. Tears and Years, that's kind of the answer. I think the first thing is you have to have a reason to write. You know, in my case, it was two things. It was literally the scene where Kira finds, she finds the suit originally, and it flows over her body and then later emerges. And then when she's drifting off at the end of the book, and literally that's all I had to start with, those two scenes. And I'm not exaggerating when I say every single word in the book, every character, everything else in the book was literally written to support that final scene and that first scene. Because when I thought of that final scene, I felt it. And if I felt it, I thought, you know, if I do my job right, I can create that feeling in the audience, in the reader. And that's the feeling I want to convey. And then all the work is simply figuring out the themes, figuring out the characters, you know, how it all ties together to build to that transcendent moment. How did you approach, you know, voicing an alien that communicates with via scent? And we had some conversations about this.
I called the writer. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this? And he was very helpful.
Oh.
No, I liked, it really was that conversation with you when I reached mm-hmm. out and you were gracious enough to respond. And that was really helpful. The formality of it, the fact that it wasn't native to the human speaker or to the Renawi speaker, the jellies, that they both were formal in where they met in the middle. Like whenever I was Kira speaking to the jellies, mm-hmm. she was also speaking in that more formal tone because mm-hmm. she was speaking them in the translation zone. Right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I hope that's okay. I'm like, oh, that look on his face, was that okay or not okay?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it was placement, really. It was arriving at a place yeah. where they speak from, where it's about where it's placed in the mouth, and it's not a lot of body. There's not a lot of body in it. It's simply mm-hmm. a communication device, but there's a personality behind it as well. Mm-hmm. And like Lafette's journey in the book is, you know, briefly as we visit with that, it was a journey, and Lafette became very self-important. It, you know, the second time you see Lafette, I was like, okay, this is Lafette now.
That's right.
Well, that's awesome. And I, you know, as an author, I love that you took so much care with the characters, that you were willing to reach out and talk about this, because that's not always the case. I mean, I've been very fortunate with Gerard Doyle, who read my previous novels. But I know talking with some other authors, you know, that sometimes that the experience is less than pleasant. So it was really lovely to work with you on that. And I have to tell you, when I got the samples, of your reading, when I first heard a chunk of your reading, from a couple different places in the book, but when I heard that, it was one of the strangest experiences for me, because I've been living with this book for so long. I mean, it's over 7 years I worked on it, and I got the original idea all the way back in 2006, 2007. So long time. And I was sitting there and I was hearing you read the book. And even though I know you hadn't worked into the story yet completely, it was surreal. And especially because I am familiar with your voice from various games. And it was wonderful too, because it was coming to life and it was outside of me instead of just being stuck up in my head, which is where it was for so long. And I'm actually very much looking forward to listening to the whole audiobook. Once I like, you couldn't pay me to read the book on paper at this point, but I want to listen. I'm going to be listening to the whole audiobook once I get it.
Do you listen to audiobooks, or do you mostly ingest your stuff through the written page?
I listen to audiobooks on occasion. The problem for me is that I read so fast that audiobooks can sometimes slow me down, but I really love listening to them when I'm walking. So,
I listen to them on like 1.25, like a little faster than the written.
That's true. That's true. But I always feel like that doesn't do justice to the performance of the reader. So, but now I listen to the audiobook for, one of my favorite fantasy novels, which is The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Eddison, which is a pre-Tolkien fantasy written in faux Jacobian English. It's just like all this wonderful linguistic experience. And, so that was a wonderful audiobook I listened to not long ago. So I, out of curiosity, on a technical level, how did basically, how did you protect your voice when reading something that's 800-900 pages long? Because I know I had to read the afterword. I mean, I didn't have to, but I enjoyed reading it, recording it, and that was that was just a couple of pages, and I was already starting to wear out my voice by then.
Yeah, you know, I've been using my voice for so many years that really what fatigues faster than my voice are my eyes. Mm. Such concentrated reading. And I actually have dyslexia and astigmatism. So I would flip words and I would pull a word from the sentence below up to the sentence that is. And I actually never, when I was a kid, you know, nobody cared. They're like, just get your stuff done, you know, whatever, go outside, you know, okay. And I never realized I was dyslexic until computers really, I had to do a lot of typing and I found myself putting the D's on the right and the J's on the left and the E's and the I's would get flipped. And I was like, what? And I was like, that's exactly backwards, huh? And then people started talking about dyslexia and I was like, oh, and if I get really stressed or tired, I will write words out of sequence. Because my brain moves really fast in my hand. It's like, keep up. You know? Sorry, hand, I love you. Thank you. But so that, those really become issues before my voice does. I mean, there were times, and actually probably my muscles in here for enunciation. I would notice sometimes an R or a, you know, like there's weird little muscles like right in here that form like R's and right here would get like, I'd like, huh, that seems to be getting weak. And I'd be like, okay, let's go. You know? But I mean, I started singing in clubs when I was 15 in rock clubs in a band, sound man who was in love with miking the drum, even if we were playing in a closet. So I had to have some power and some machinery underneath me since I was 15. And I watched the singers in town. There was one particular gig where every singer lost their voice because it was 6 hours a night and it's 6 days and it started at 10 p.m. And I was like 16, a lot of sixes in there. So I went to a classical singing teacher who taught me opera technique. Mm. And I have kind of a freakishly large rib cage. And I swear, I think that's part of it is I've been just working these muscles since then. And I still have a teacher that I go to, shout out to Bill Haller. He, teaches like a Broadway belt technique. And every now and then, if I need a check-in, I was recording some songs, last fall. And there was one that I wrote and I wanted to do an octave harmony. And I'm like, oh my God, this sounds horrible. So I ran back to Bill. I'm like, Bill, he's like, remember this, remember that? I'm like, ah, thank you. And, so, I mean, I stay in shape. This is my instrument. It's like you playing with words for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, that machinery is just second nature for you. I think I've done this my whole life. So the machinery is largely second nature. And if I'm getting tired, I go a different place than you will. You know, if you're getting tired, you're like, oh, is it okay? If I'm getting tired, I'm like, oh, drop the ball. Okay. Ribs out, you know, jaw strong, muscles strong, oxygen. And I'll tighten all through my whole entire upper torso will be like a brick support system for this. Technique, I guess. Is there anything that you want people to know about this story that we haven't touched on? That's not in the words, that's not in the book. Anything you want people to know?
There are a lot of things that will probably become clear with some more future books that sort of tie into this one, because there are layers upon layers here. But I think the biggest one is, for me, this book is a dream. You know, the reason I wrote it, the reason I had that image of Kira drifting off into the darkness, it was a feeling like a dream. And writing it was in some ways like a dream. And I hope that, you know, it is not a perfect work. No work is, but for all its flaws and for all its successes, that ultimately that's what people will take away from this, is that those feelings and that sense of awe and wonder and hope.
Mm. Beautiful. That's how I felt.
I was lucky to have such a good reader.
I hope you like it. No, I really,
I know I do.
I loved it. It was, wow, what a great experience. And I'd do it again in a hot second. It was so
cool. Well, I'll be calling you up when I've got a sequel about Kira.
In.